This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today about Witness for Peace and a recent emergency delegation that went to Oaxaca, Mexico. Mike Mulberry is our guest. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Steve.
Tell us when this delegation went to Mexico.
Went to Mexico December 1st through December 8th. I received notice of it through an organization that I participate in called Illinois Maya Ministry that's a part of the United Church of Christ's Illinois Conference.
How many people went?
We had a total of about 16 or 17 people, including those folks from the international team of Witness for Peace. We had folks from Amnesty International who were part of that delegation the first time that their presence was there. And we had independent journalists, teachers. So it was a good mix of people from all over the United States, New York to Oregon, Washington, D.C., and Champaign, Illinois.
Here in Champaign-Urbana, the Amnesty International group is sponsored by the University of Hawaii, as you know, and we have many students who are involved in that. Were there other people from Champaign-Urbana who went on this particular mission?
No, there were two other people from Chicago, one person who has worked in progressive social justice movements in the Chicago area, and another person who was a former Mary Noel missionary who had been in Oaxaca for some time, and she had a love for Oaxaca that brought her back to this emergency delegation.
People have heard about Oaxaca on radio, television, newspapers, magazines, so forth, but for those who may not have a clear idea of where in Mexico it is, could you tell us, please?
Yeah, it's in the southern part of Mexico, borders the Pacific Ocean, and also is bordered by Chiapas, which is the southernmost state of Mexico, which butts right up against Guatemala.
And it's a popular tourist area.
Yes, it is. You would expect to see a lot of people in Oaxaca's downtown area. It's known for its good food, its festivals. It has, in fact, had an overhaul by the current government of Oaxaca as a way to make it more attractive to tourists. So the tourist trade is a huge part of Oaxaca's economy.
But the Witness for Peace emergency delegation went to Oaxaca because of the violence.
They did. There was some concern because Oaxaca had never been a place that had been a locale for violence, and this was radically changing. And Witness for Peace saw it as the beginning of a long-term social discontent that had been building in Oaxaca. 76% of Oaxacans live in poverty or dire poverty, and the results of the North American Free Trade Agreement had resulted in a populace that had one time been 80% subsistence corn farmers to being almost no subsistence corn farmers as corn from companies like ADM and Cargill flooded the Oaxacan markets.
Now, how did you get involved?
I got involved largely because I saw an email that came across from one of my Illinois Maya Ministry colleagues that said that the emergency delegation was going. I had been involved as a missionary in Chiapas for about a year between my second and third year of seminary, and had seen some of these same things happen and occur in Chiapas as a result of larger issues, and knew that try to, over the past two or three years, go on a BorderLinks delegation, which explores some of the immigration and border issues along the Tucson, United States, Tucson, USA border with Mexico. And one of the things that we were learning in Chiapas was that there were whole towns that were absent of men in Chiapas because they were immigrating to the United States, having the choice between dying with their families in Chiapas or going north to find something else to do.
Dying from poverty and hunger, or dying from violence?
Poverty and hunger largely, although certainly the poverty and hunger was exacerbating situations in Chiapas and leading to some violent repression and violent confrontation, which resulted in, as NAFTA was approved, was, of course, the historic date when the Zapatista uprising occurred in Chiapas, Mexico. And that was really the first hunger pangs of what was going to go on, not only in Chiapas, but then, as we now have learned, go to Oaxaca as well.
Now, you're a United Church of Christ pastor here at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign, but you had this experience as a young pastor in Chiapas. You speak Spanish.
Yeah, I try to.
All right. and you've when you heard about this delegation going, you signed up to go. Now, how does that get paid for?
Well, it gets paid for because I had a congregation that really rallied to help me get to that place. And Illinois Maya Ministry also helped me a little bit. But it really was my congregation at Community UCC that helped foot the bill for this. And I had to check with my wife to see if she was okay with this, because the security protocols were very high with what was going on in Oaxaca. And we knew that this could end up being a really messy situation if things turn sour.
And you have a child, children?
I have two boys. One is soon to turn 15, and one is 13. And I have a daughter who is 5.
And how did your children feel about you going to one of these dangerous spots in the world?
Well, I don't know that my boys quite understood what was going on, but of course my daughter picked up on the cues from her mom, and she was not all excited that I would go. Uh-huh. So,
were you in danger?
It felt like it at times. There were some, I think when you're really afraid like that, you have some moments that are somewhat comical, such as, it's not funny to think of in terms of Oaxaca, but the leader of Oaxaca, or the leader of APO, the union that was a part of the struggle, he had been detained and was all over the newspapers throughout Mexico. And so his picture showed up, and one of the people, an independent journalist from Maine, one of the people in our delegation looked exactly like this guy. So as the police, as we'd walk by, these police in full riot gear would look at him and would wonder why the reincarnation of Flavio Sosa was walking the streets of Oaxaca City. And we would make jokes with him. We're walking two steps behind you, and so forth. There were people with automatic weapons there. We saw and heard of incredible violence. There was a massacre in a school in which teachers were macheted to death in front of their classrooms. And so the danger was real, and we had a couple of times when we knew that people were listening in on our conversations. So, and we were told by missionaries, U.S. missionaries in Oaxaca, that people knew that we were there. One of the large reasons was when we first arrived, we were the only gringos in Oaxaca City.
So the tourists were avoiding it because of the violence.
Yeah, they were at that time. By the end of the time that we were there, it started to pick up a little bit, but it was pretty clear that it was not as vibrant as Oaxaca usually is.
Now, you mentioned missionaries. Those are Christian missionaries?
Christian missionaries.
Protestant, Catholic, what?
Largely Catholic. I'm going to kind of keep silent about that because in terms of who those people are, largely because those folks, if it were known who in particular those folks were, they would be expelled from Mexico. That was done in Chiapas, and you were not supposed to be doing anything of substance as a U.S.-born missionary in Mexico.
Why is that?
U.S. national. Part of their constitution, I think it harkens back to some of the communist government in Mexico that had a split between religion and the state, in which, at one time, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but the Catholic Church could not hold any land in Mexico. And so what the Catholic Church did was got large private interests to buy up particular land that would then be given over to the church.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Mike Mulberry. Reverend Mulberry is a pastor at Community United Church of Christ in Champaign on the corner of 6th and Daniel, right in the heart of the University of Illinois campus. He's reporting on an experience he and several others from the United States had as part of a Witness for Peace, an emergency delegation that was in Oaxaca, Mexico, early in December. We're happy to have him on the program, and if listeners would like to ask him questions, to make comments from their own experience or knowledge of this situation, do call. This is a live program every Sunday afternoon here on WILL AM 580. The phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. Elsewhere, you may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So even if you're listening on the Internet anywhere in the continental U.S., you may call us toll-free. You may be at our website, WILL.UIUC.edu, and listening to AM 580 there live on through your computer. So do use the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455, for those calls. But in Champaign-Urbana, you can reach two or three local lines at 333-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Mike's been on this program before, so we won't spend a whole lot of time getting his personal background. We'll keep talking, at this point at least, about his experience as part of this delegation. Mike, tell us a little bit about the history of the violence in Oaxaca.
Yeah. I think some of that is to, again, begin to get a little bit of a backdrop in terms of the poverty that was already there, indigenous state. Oaxaca has over 16 indigenous groups within it, many of them conquered by the Aztecs as they moved through. It's the fifth largest state in Mexico.
How many people?
3.5 million.
How many in Oaxaca City?
I don't know how many in Oaxaca City, but I would say I felt the equivalent would have been, something a little bit smaller than Champaign-Urbana.
Okay.
But a rather vibrant city center, as I said. But it really began, the timeline of events began in May. The teachers have a traditional strike. Because of some of those systemic things.
These are public school teachers?
Public school teachers, okay. Part of a union that is the National Union of Education Workers. And that's one of the reasons that I also went, Steve, is because this made a lot of sense for me, as I'm the son of public school teachers and also the brother of two public school teachers. And I belong to a church and am pastor of a church that has public school teachers as kind of its MO. So it really felt like I was there on behalf of my own folk. But they would go in Oaxaca, go on strike every year, demanding pay increases, improve working conditions. And one of the things that they were also asking for is an increased budget for school meals, uniforms, and supplies. The teachers there would talk about how they a lot of times would have to supply clothing and food and shoes for the people there in Oaxaca, the students that would come in. A student who would come in and would get, after walking 4 miles to school, a tortilla and a glass of water for his meal with no breakfast. June 14th, the governor of Oaxaca, who had promised that he would make sure that the teacher strike did not go long, Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, PRI, which is the party that really has still the institutional control over Mexico, much like one might talk about the Democratic Party in Chicago. He sent over 1,000 state police into the historic town of center of Oaxaca City before dawn to break up the teachers' protest camps. He used tear gas, percussion grenades, and they beat protesters with clubs. The teachers regrouped at about 40,000 strong and took back the town center hours later.
Now, this was back in June.
Yeah, that was back
June
in June.
Of this year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And since that time, there have been a number of marches and protests. But what happened out of that was the outrage that the government would do something like that, that had become part of Oaxacan culture, is that you had tens of thousands of Oaxacans, which included poor farmers, union leaders, church leaders, join with the teachers to become what has become known the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca, or APO.
I want to get back to that, but we do have a caller waiting on our toll-free line, line number four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Previously, you talked about the Mexican immigrants coming up here because the corn prices were depressed. And what I wondered about was, since a lot of the LDP subsidies to corn farmers here are off the table because the prices are so high, what effect has that had upon immigration of farm workers in Mexico?
Well, I think it has had a chilling effect, to say the least. Is what has really happened is that around harvest time, a tremendous amount of corn is poured into the Mexican economy. And as a result of that, local producers, particularly subsistence farmers, are can buy corn cheaper at the local market from a U.S. multinational than they can in growing their own corn. Now, remember that they can get corn cheaper, grown and produced in the United States, shipped to Mexico from those multinationals than they can to produce it. So they are driven out of their economy as local producers. And what the United States offers in return, or the Mexican economy from the United States, is these maquiladoras, or factories that are set up. Well, what has happened now is that whatever these factories produce can be produced even more cheaply in China. And so U.S. multinationals have left Mexico to go to China. And the one rather poor safety net that Mexican subsistence farmers had is now gone. And that means that you either die with your family in Mexico, or you emigrate north to try to find work at the border or in the United States. Not much of a choice.
Now, Mike, you've talked about some of the results you've seen from the NAFTA policies. Has it helped anybody?
Well, I think it has helped if you're talking about those wealthy folk within Oaxaca, maybe wealthy business folk who want the most modern appliances. You're going to be able to get that, and I don't mean to impugn any multinational by just throwing out names, but a Whirlpool dishwasher that you've always wanted, where you may not have been able to get that technology before. That is now available.
So that's now cheaper because there aren't the added prices, taxes, costs.
Right. I'm not sure so much cheaper as available. The way has been open for commerce to go. I would say that the protective taxes and tariffs that Mexico had really were there to keep subsistence people alive. Oaxaca even had a policy that if subsistence farmers had some corn, that they would buy from Oaxaca corn first before they turned elsewhere. Now all of that's gone. It's whatever is the cheapest. And, of course, with our industrial agriculture receiving subsidies that Mexican agriculture does not, we are able to basically drive out local producers. I refer to it as the Walmarting of Mexico. You move into an area, you lower prices because you have the economic power to sustain and do so. And then when local producers are driven out, what we've seen happen recently is what goes on too often in our local communities is the prices go way up because now they've got you. And we've heard about recently the tortilla and corn prices in Mexico being out of sight. And I think one of the reasons that we're going to mitigate some of that is because it's affecting more than the poor in Mexico.
I want to get back to some of those issues, but we left one when the last caller asked his question. You were talking about the response to the – well, first of all, there was the teacher strike. Then there was the state police response called in by the governor. And then there was the joining of the teachers by many other people in the Oaxaca area. What happened then?
Well, marches began happening at regular intervals to protest what had gone on. And one of the more famous ones was, I think it was the Casserole or the Pots and Pans March of 3,000 women who marched down to the local TV station and nonviolently took over the TV station as a show of what collective power could do. And in August, there were reports of civilian-clad state and federal police and unidentified gunmen who began to shoot at protest marches and encampments all around Oaxaca City. APO leaders were arrested on the street, and then APO, as a result, nonviolently took over 12 local commercial radio stations.
Now, APO is the union.
Yeah, APO is the union. They took over 12 radio stations and then released 10 of those later. But there were two protesters killed in some of those marches. Many more were wounded. APO organized then throughout the city 1,000 barricades to stop the incursion of gunmen or police, because these would usually happen at like 2 or 3 in the morning when they would show up at some of these encampments. So they're trying to stop their free flow and protect themselves.
Now, has the union used violence as well?
Well, that's a good question, is that the guy who's reporting for Global Exchange, and you can hear him on Democracy Now! Making regular reports, Brad Gibler, or John Gibler is his name, he told us that, you know, when he was out trying to get a story, there were these APO young guys walking around with clubs in their hands, with a nail sticking out of the clubs. Now, you know, he got quizzed by them and nothing ever happened. And he says they also were unloading buses. And he says one of the funniest stories of the movement is that as they were unloading buses to use them for barricades, one of the women on the bus refused to get off the bus. She said these young whippersnappers were not going to make her get off a bus. And there they were with the clubs, but they didn't do anything with them. They just sent the bus on and unloaded the next one. So there's the threat of nonviolent or the threat of violence, but from what he has seen, the violence has really come about because the state and federal government has tried to infiltrate some of the APO movement, and as a result, they try to then discredit APO through doing violence like setting afire buildings or throwing rocks through windows and so forth.
Has the U.S. government taken an official stand on any of this?
U.S. government has just issued travel warnings for Oaxaca City. I think that all of Latin America lucks out that the United States government's attention is turned toward Iraq and the situation there, which has allowed for some of these movements to go forward. But there has been, as I know, no official statement other than to talk about civil unrest and to largely blame, APO and the movement for some of that civil unrest.
Now, tell us about the government of Mexico. You mentioned this particular governor in Oaxaca, this state far to the south, almost to Guatemala. But what's the federal government like in Mexico at this point?
Federal government in Mexico has recently had the machine operation of PRI broken by the election of some PAN candidates, P-A-N. And Felipe Calderon was the most recent candidate to be installed as the president of Mexico on December 1st. Calderon ends up being a candidate who had a hotly contested election with the PRD candidate, Obrador, and that was, many contend, thought to be a sham election with some real voting irregularities that occurred. And Obrador has tried to set up a parallel government in one that would speak to some of the social concerns. And you can already hear in Calderon's message some of the real scary things that go along with free trade and neoliberal economics, the cut of social welfare programs, so that
neoliberal or neoconservative economics,
neoliberal economics. Oh. Neoliberal economics was a term coined for the Chicago Boys, which were a group of Chilean people who went to the University of Chicago, studied at the University of Chicago, and came back to Chile to throw out democratically elected Salvador Allende, install Pinochet, and then basically turn Chile upside down with a heavy hand. And that was really the testing ground for neoliberal economics, which basically says we are going to pretend like everybody is on equal footing and open up our economy multinational organizations and corporations throughout the world. And what that sets up is then subsistence farmers in many of these countries have to do battle with or struggle with these multinational corporations, and they just do not, subsistence farmers do not have the resources to outlast the economic power of multinational corporations.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with Reverend Mike Mulberry from the Community United Church of Christ, who, along with several others from this country, went on an emergency delegation to Oaxaca, Mexico, as part of Witness for Peace in early December. Folks who'd like to ask him a question are invited to call in. 333-9455 are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana. Several local lines can be reached at 333-WILL. Elsewhere are toll-free lines available, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. Next week I'll be talking with Frank Dimmock, who will be visiting from Malawi. We'll be talking about health issues in the southern region of Africa, including Malawi. Frank Dimmock is a U.S. citizen who's been in Malawi many years, he and his wife and their own children and their adopted children. And we'll be hearing about health issues in that region. That's February 4. February 18, Michael Shapiro will be our guest. And that'll start a three-session series of programs that are dealing with some of the issues in the St. John's Passion that will be performed here March 17. We'll be talking about whether the language in the St. John's Passion is anti-Semitic. On the 18th, on February 25th, we'll be talking about the Gospel of John, on which that magnificent musical work is based, with Professor Rick Layton and Chet Alvis, who's a professor of music, will be our guest March 4. So we'll be having a series dealing with issues around the Bach St. John's Passion. Stephen Hartnett will be our guest March 11, talking about poetry from prison. April 1, Palm Sunday, our guest will be John Sutherland by phone, live from the Holy Land, talking about Palm Sunday in the Holy Land. Well, we have a couple of callers waiting. Let's get to those calls quickly. But let me remind folks that this program is sponsored partially by the University YMCA, where Communiversity classes will be starting up, tonight and tomorrow. The dance classes begin tomorrow with Aurora Villa Corte. People who'd like to take ballroom dance can show up and learn about all those kinds of things. There'll be two sessions. There are also classes on food and wine and Philippine cooking. And if you haven't seen a catalog, you can find one at your local library at the University Y at corner of Chalmers and Wright. You can check online at universityymca.org and then look on Communiversity if you'd like some of those classes. There's poetry classes, how to publish your book, English as a second language opportunities, beginning knitting, karate for kids, other martial arts, music appreciation, religion, spirituality, some fascinating classes this semester, yoga. So do check out the catalog for CUMUniversity. If you don't have access to a computer, give us a call tomorrow at 337-1500. We have a caller waiting on line number one. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Hi. Hope you can hear me. I'm on a cell phone.
Yeah, we got you.
Just a little bit of contextual stuff. For people who are not familiar with Mexico, it's certainly not as large as the United States. And something people need to understand is that Oaxaca, the state that you're speaking of, which is a beautiful place, is very close to Guerrero, which is a big state where Acapulco is, and that actually Guerrero has had pretty much an armed insurgency throughout most of modern history in the middle of Mexico. It's a very large straight state, and it's the word where guerrilla, guerrilla, comes from, is from Guerrero. And the other thing is I think the history of poverty in Mexico is crucial to understanding the way the people feel. When you had the revolution, the second revolution, 3% of the people owned like 9% of the land in Mexico. And when they had the revolution, it's what
did you say? Did you say 9% or 90%?
Sorry. Almost all the land in Mexico was owned by 3% yeah. of the wealthy people.
Right.
And when they had their revolution, which is shortly before World War I, they did establish what we would call a local communist system where people own the land in common in these small communes called ejidos, but they were administered by the local people for the benefit of the local people. But this division between rich and poor is so deep in Mexican culture that it overwhelms anything. And the cynicism of the Mexicans towards their own government is just something I think Americans maybe can't understand. But what I'd like to ask is, how did the people treat you as a gringo visiting there in Mexico in this very tough time? I would assume they were very concerned for your safety and probably expressed that. So I just want to sit back and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
And thanks for the context. I think that that's right. I think also some of that context is to talk about things like the Monroe Doctrine and some of the Mexican War and all of that that contributed to some of this as well. But we were treated very well, although it was interesting. We were the one trip we took outside of Oaxaca City because we did not feel like it was too safe to go to too many other places. We felt like the city gave us a little bit of protection. And, you know, we were told things as we left Oaxaca City that we were not to carry with us a film from our cameras, or we were to remove from digital cameras the memory cards so that if we were stopped, the police would not see what we had taken pictures of going forward. And several of the journalists had had tape recorders and were told to come up with new tapes as we went. When we came into Zaachila, what we found was a group of teachers. We thought that we were not going to have enough homes to host us. When we got there, we found the contrasting part was true. In fact, my experience of Latin American hospitality was justified all over again, in that some families were upset that they didn't get somebody from the delegation to come home with them. And they were kind of bargaining, well, I'm a better cook and stuff like that, and I have a better story to tell. But they were very the word in Spanish language is animado, and what we might say as inspired or filled with the spirit of the movement, and talking very openly about not NAFTA, free trade, global economics. They were even saying that there was going to be a Sam's Club and a Walmart put just outside their city that was going to destroy the already worsening ecosystem in their community, and that the aquifer that was pristine, that was the one resource they had, was going to be used by this Walmart and Sam's Club. And they were worried that that would spell the end of their particular resources in the area. There was also a big bedroom community that was going up outside, just outside their community for Oaxaca City. And of course, you can go on the internet, and if you want to buy a home, they are strongly advertising it to U.S. citizens as a second home that you can have just outside of Oaxaca City. And the people were very afraid and wanted to get the news out through whatever megaphone they could. And so we were greeted as people who could quickly run up to our government. I think they had a rather naive notion of what we could do. And we were kind of almost backpacing, saying, hey, we're going to work with our country's policies as much as we can, but we have no guarantees of what we can do. And it was amazing to see public school teachers who came forward to talk to us saying that they had an arrest warrant out for them, and that they believed in the struggle and that they would gladly die in the struggle. They would gladly go to prison in the struggle. And there was even a 70-year-old indigenous woman who stepped forward to say that she had an arrest warrant out for her because she had been in some of the marches where they had taken her picture, and now she feared that she was going to end up in one of those federal prisons that were about 16 hours away where people were saying that torture was taking place. So,
when you talk about the situation overall in Mexico, the teachers there who are striking have a realistic sense of where any money would come from? You've talked about the agriculture economy having failed. You talked about the factories that came in after NAFTA now being gone. Where would money come from?
Well, I think, unfortunately, and this is where it gets really tough for we as North Americans, because we don't often talk about distributive justice too much without being called commies or something else derogatory. But my way of thinking is that God can be defined as a God of distributive justice. And I think what all of us are looking for and asking for is the whole systemic model. Mexico-U.S. relations has to change so that there is a more egalitarian way that funds are dispersed throughout the Mexican economy. But number one, we have to get past the idea that free trade and neoliberal economics, which has been characterized as so good and all positive, has done incredible damage to our ecosystems, has done damage to labor in the United States, and continues to do damage to the poor and subsistence folk in all of Latin America. Particularly, there's a new movement afoot called Plan Puebla Panama, where they are trying to build infrastructure in terms of roads that will then allow countries like the United States to load up the resources in Oaxaca and get them to the coast where they can be then shipped north or all over the world. In Chiapas, they always had a phrase that I thought was very appropriate for this struggle, is that we grow blue ribbon coffee and we drink Nescafe. I think that that kind of sums up the Mexican experience of how they have had so many of their God-given resources taken away from them and been given instead resources that come from the United States fully processed.
What are some of the resources in Oaxaca?
Resources in Oaxaca have to do with, of course, corn. Oaxaca is where corn was born and has some of the sturdiest and oldest corn known to humankind. There is a fear that as cross-pollination occurs with these U.S. varieties, that there will be the loss of those kinds of that kind of diversity within the Oaxacan ecosystem. I think what people always talk about with Oaxaca is the tremendous indigenous culture, which is being homogenized out of Oaxaca with the import of so much U.S. culture. And, of course, so much of Mexican culture comes from Mexico City. There is loss of that is talked about. And, of course, as my daughter can tell you, one of the great delicacies in Oaxaca, as they talk about all their great food, is grasshoppers. I brought back some grasshoppers that have been cooked in garlic and butter, and she has yet to open the package to give one of those a taste. But I think the greatest resource in Oaxaca, what we saw in people among teachers in Zaachila, is the greatest resource is the people, that there are people who believe in the rightness of their struggle and the justice for not only them but for the students, the labor leaders, for the indigenous farmers who are a part of what has become known as APO.
What was the goal of the Witness for Peace delegation? What did you hope to accomplish?
The goal was to do exactly what I am doing now, is to return to the United States and to become a mouthpiece for changing United States policy. Because Witness for Peace hopes to continue working in Mexico, they cannot ever talk about the need for change of Mexican policy. Witness for Peace actively works to try to get United States policy changed and for more awareness to be built in the United States of just how terrible some of our policies, what they are doing to the populace when our media is spreading a very different gospel about how great free trade and neoliberal economics, how the statistics are all skewing towards the development of the Mexican economy.
Phone numbers to join this conversation in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Folks who are listening on the internet at will.uiuc.edu may call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. So anywhere where it's a long-distance call, use the 1-800-222-WILL number. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. I see we do have a caller. We're on line number four. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi, I'm just driving down from Chicago. Appreciate the conversation. Can the person speaking talk about the role of School of the Americas in training the military? So to emphasize the role of the U.S. in terms of contributing to the violence, the U.S. foreign policy.
Thank you for the call. Mike Mulberry, our guest. Go ahead.
Yeah, School of the Americas is one of those places in Fort Benning, Georgia, where for a long time it has been known that Latin American military folk have been trained to go back and wreak havoc in their own countries. We had from Illinois Maya Ministry and a Disciples UCC minister, Don Coleman. You may know Don Steve, who crossed the line at the School of the Americas and now faces a prison term there for protesting and trying to shut down the School of the Americas. Been long known for training people to go back to Latin America, and it has even been thought that the loyalty that is built between the commanders at the School of the Americas and these particular Latin American military folk leads to assassination attempts on Latin American leaders who will not cooperate with U.S. foreign and trade and economic policy. So some very evil things have continued to come out of the School of the Americas. I believe the greatest number of that training has happened for Mexican military leaders. So the School of the Americas plays an important role in creating unrest in Mexico, or I should say, creating violent situations in Mexico, which lead to violations of human rights. I know that the greatest human rights violator in the Western Hemisphere came from Guatemala, and he was highly decorated at the School of the Americas. So, the only worry, of course, in all of this is that if not the School of the Americas, and we do get Fort Benning, Georgia closed, then we as a people have to be persistent and consistent in our movement, making sure that any place where dictators or violence is trained, we need to seek that out and find ways to struggle with it so that nonviolence and peace become the way of the world.
Caller, do you want to follow up? Are you still there? I think he asked his question and then went on. Now, the School of the Americas has a new name.
Yeah, it's strategic of the Western Hemisphere. I've heard School of the Americas so much that I've forgotten the regular name that is used. But it is in Fort Benning, Georgia. There is a protest every year, and I believe every year a certain number of people decide to cross the boundary that is there as a way of becoming imprisoned. I think of those kinds of marches, like the marches in Oaxaca, as holy pilgrimages, ways of saying that there is another way in the land, and it is not by violence and coercion and brutality.
Now, in terms of your own theology, how did you come to be committed to these kind of causes, to be involved in these kind of movements? Does it grow out of your Christian beliefs at all?
Oh, I think that's fundamental, is that one of my favorite theologians that I just got to see in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is John Dominic Crossan. And Crossan defines God as justice, and in particular as distributive justice, and that that God is active in the world, working from below to turn the world aright. And I think, in particular, for me, I have to go on a delegation like this or go to Latin America because it ends up being a touchstone for me of my faith. If I stay too long in the United States, kind of trying to continue the struggle, I find that where I think I may have one foot outside of empire, I find my other foot creeping to the other side of the fence, where I'm wholly bought and purchased by the empire and can't get out of that. Crossan and some other theologians like Richard Horsley have come to define Christianity in the first century as anti-empire. And based on the reading that I do and my faith struggle, I would agree with that understanding. And so in the mix, we need to be a people as Christians, out of our particularity of our faith, who find a way to step outside of empire to offer an alternative way.
We have another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Mike Mulberry.
I would like to raise the question, Mr. Mulberry, about what response he's had to his message as he talks to different groups in this country. How open and ready are our people to understand the justice problems that you've described?
Of course, always a mixed reaction. I think I live a very charmed life pastoring the church that I do at Community UCC, that I get a fairly good reception. But I do believe that I come back right into the heart of the issues that we are talking about, you know, that Archer Daniels Midland is advertised as the supermarket of the world here on WILL from time to time and is just a piece down the road from here, headquartered. There are a lot of folks in the College of Aces on the University of Illinois campus who are great folk, folks even within my own church, but industrial agriculture pours a ton of money into the College of Aces. That's what makes this a very difficult issue, is that we're all complicit in some way, and we all are somewhat supported by a system that is unjust and creating such pain in the world. And how do we extricate ourselves from that? I think that's a real faith issue, is that, you know, Hitler, as I understand it, before World War II, really paralyzed the church by getting them to see their complicity in all the evil that was going on. And it took some great and brave theologians of that time to say that grace allowed them to go forward, because even though they could acknowledge they participated in the system, they were going to try to find ways to offer an alternative life or an alternative view.
Caller, did you want to follow up?
It seems to me that the crux of the problem is not just our political leaders, but also the American people need to be aware of the hardships that are showing up as a result of U.S. policies.
No doubt about that. There are not a lot of folk that, when I say neoliberal economics or free trade, or even to talk about NAFTA, who I don't see a general glaze come over them, when I mentioned those things. Those are difficult issues. I never expected when I went to seminary that I would have to learn as much about politics and economics as I have. But I think it behooves us all so that we can begin to talk about what it means to be a democracy, to learn what these programs and policies are, and then to find a way to speak our own values to these programs and policies so that we can become a more humane, just, and loving society.
I heard someone say that it would be great if our country could be seen by the poor and troubled of the earth as a friend.
Yeah.
We have come into an era of time, apparently from your report and from other things we hear, when many people in desperate circumstances in the world regard us not as their friend.
I would agree. I think the history of Latin America has been a long and unfortunate one. I do think that one of the things that I'm proudest of is that Christianity and a lot of faith communities often get bashed for their complicity in much of some of the politics that goes on. And I think that there has been a movement underneath through things like the sanctuary movement, through civil rights, through siding with the poor and oppressed in the world that faith communities have taken a part in that has at times created incredible transformation. And that's what I'm hoping will happen out of this situation.
Go, go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. Let me ask maybe an unfair question, but if not free market capitalism, what?
Well, I think that Nicaragua offered an example of a possibility where there was a mix of free market capitalism and socialism, where literacy rates went through the roof, where infant mortality rates very much slowed. And I'm hoping that now that Daniel Ortega is leading the country once again, that some of that may return to Nicaragua. And I do think that that was an incredible example that they were trying to do all the while the United States was forming a blockade around Nicaragua to not let any resources in or out. And we were supposedly fined an incredible amount of money by the United Nations for that blockade, which, to my understanding, we've largely ignored. I think Nicaragua offered an example, and I think for the United States, they became very fearful of that example. And so Nicaragua and its government had to be demonized to the point where we talked about Sandinistas coming up through the Texas border to take on our military and what I thought was complete and utter nonsense. So I do think from a faith perspective, there are examples like James Carroll talked about in his book, Constantine's Sword, of convivencia, where Jews, Christians, and Muslims are worshiping in each other's buildings and living together and learning from each other. And that is my hope for our economy, our spirituality, and our politics.
What policies of the U.S. government would you like to see changed?
Well, I think, as you could probably tell, I want NAFTA to go down for the count. I would like for our country to begin to understand that if we're going to compete in the world economy in the future, Latin America is going to have to come up to a level that is somewhat of an equal partner with the United States. We have kept those countries as much as we can as our lackeys, and I think we're going to pay for that, those chickens are going to come home to roost when the European Union finally comes together, and they are approaching things in a much different way in trying to support the economy of Poland and Portugal so that they become equal partners, so capital does not flee to those places and that the populace doesn't flee out of those places, much like we have in Latin America. And when they finally get organized and get together, I think they are going to be much more or much economically stronger than what we are. And as a result of that, I think there are going to be some tragic circumstances that will occur for our economy at that time.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Mike Mulberry, who's pastor of Community United Church of Christ in Champaign on the corner of 6th Street and Daniels. Tell us a little bit about your congregation.
Congregation refers to it as itself as a just peace, open and affirming, progressive Christian congregation. We are a congregation that welcomes the gay and lesbian community into our midst and finds that their gifts have a lot to say to us. We are an inclusive congregation, not only of the gay and lesbian community, but also of other different ability peoples. And we are struggling with our identity and the downturn of the mainline denomination and finding that we have life as we become a congregation that recognizes that God is still speaking not only in the world, but in little old Champaign-Urbana. We have a lot of exciting things going on. We just approved a new polity at our church. And
new type of church government.
Yeah, thank you, yes. I always forget that that's a term of art. A new form of church government that we hope will lead us out based on our values. And a lot of people have worked hard to determine what the future of our church will be. And we have a great history in the abolitionist movement. And also Jack Good paved the way through helping along with you to set up things like the Martin Luther King Jr. Scholarship celebration. So
to help minority students from this community get to college.
Yeah. And so great history.
Well, thank you to our guest today, Mike Mulberry. We've been talking about the emergency delegation that he was a part of Witness for Peace in Oaxaca, Mexico, back in December. And thank you to Mike for being on the program and for the callers for their comments and questions. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs that are heard every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580, a listener-supported radio service of the College of Communications of the University of Illinois. I'm director of the University YMCA, and the Y is the oldest continuous student organization on this campus. It's been going on 134 years here. Communiversity, or one of our non-graded classes and activities that we sponsor every semester, and coming up this semester, starting tonight and tomorrow at the University of Y, classes on how to run a political campaign, classes on how to start your own business, classes on mothers acting up, classes on sexual assault, awareness, survival, and action. Reflections on the life of the spirit. Classes on the Baha'i faith, music appreciation, martial arts, dance, all sorts of classes. If you'd like to learn more about these, they're very inexpensive and fun. Usually in the evening, give the Y a call, 337-1500, or look at our website, universityymca.org. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
In 1933, novelist James Hilton wrote of an earthly paradise hidden in the Himalayas. He called it Shangri-La. Hilton didn't invent the idea. Myths about Shangri-La go back centuries. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll go in search of this earthly paradise. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a low around 5 degrees and west winds 15 to 20 miles per hour, becoming southwest around 10 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow, the high in the mid-20s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with scattered flurries, the low around 14 degrees with west winds around 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.